Senate Committee on Labor. June 1st, 8 o'clock, Hearing Room B. Come to order and call the roll. Senator Hannan.
Here.
Senator Houck.
Here.
Senator Kitzhaber.
Here.
Senator McCoy.
Here.
Senator Wyers. Senator Brown. Senator Hendrickson.
Here. We're going to change the order of business a little bit and go to House Bill 2883 and open the public hearing, and I'd like to call on Representative Ryken, who's the requester. We have Dr. Steve, is it Stiver?
Yes, Stiver. Steve Stiver.
Stiver's with you?
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Max Ryken, House District 4. I had House Bill 2883 introduced at the request of Mr. Steve Stivers, Director for Action, a federal agency for volunteer programs. Among the programs for which the agency is responsible are, number one, the Senior Volunteer Program, a program to provide volunteer opportunities for low-income senior citizens 60 years of age or older to give persons-to-person assistance to elderly people. And second, the Foster Grandparents Program, to provide volunteer opportunities for low-income senior citizens to help children with special needs in health, education, welfare, and related settings. The purpose of House Bill 2883 is related to the payments of stipends to volunteers in the Senior Volunteer Program and the Foster Grandparents Program. These volunteers serve 20 hours a week during the year and receive one meal and transportation cost related to their volunteer activity. They also receive an enabling stipend of $2 an hour. This money is meant as an enabling fund to allow low-income elderly to participate in a volunteering program. The funds are not meant to supplement income, nor are they treated as income for taxing purposes or unemployment benefits. As Federal Public Law 96-418 states, stipends are not to be considered wages or salary supplements or to provide employment. The problem we have run into is the State Accident Insurance Fund. Interpretation of the enabling funds. SAFE has determined these funds to be wages for the purpose of workers' compensation payments. Action is paying approximately $31,000 per year for SAFE. Passage of this bill would free up enough money to pay for an additional 11 volunteers in Oregon. SAFE would be replaced by the Federal Volunteer Insurance, the same program that covers all other Action volunteers. Volunteers in the Foster Grandparents programs and the senior companion programs render the same services as volunteers in the RSVP program, that is the Retired Senior Volunteers program, who are not paid a stipend and are not covered by SAFE. The stipend is paid with federal dollars on a matching base, 90% federal and the minimum of 10% local. Passage of House Bill 2883 will free up extra money for more volunteers, and it will not take anything away from our low-income volunteers.
Madam Chairperson?
Senator McCoy.
Yes, when did they start doing, when did this come down, SAFE decide to do the taxing of the wages?
They always have done that.
Have they? They've always done
as long as the program was in place.
I didn't, they do it when I was director. If they did, I didn't remember.
I think so, Senator, yes,
yeah,
since the inception of the program.
Yeah.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Brown.
Max, could you, fill in just 30 seconds on the federal insurance that is provided? Is this medical insurance or disability compensation insurance? You said there's some sort of federal insurance in place that will
fill the
breach here.
That's an insurance that's not in place for all volunteers. It gives you less coverage than under SAFE, but it gives, according to Dr. Stivers here, gives the volunteers enough protection we have, they're insured only from home to the job, isn't that right? That's not on the job itself.
Yes, they are covered.
On the job itself.
There are three payments, Senator. One payment is covered their automobile accident insurance. Yeah. The second is personal liability in case that they were caused any problems, say they someone were injured because of
so
their
voluntary. Collision and public liability.
And the accident. That's the excess auto accident. They also have a personal liability insurance that covers their volunteer activity. That's why we're working with someone in case they caused an injury, overturned a, I don't know what would happen, but at any rate, where they would be liable for a suit for a personal suit against negligence or something like that. And the third is a...
Do you want to identify yourself for the record, please?
I'm sorry. My name is Steve Stivers. I'm the State Program Director for the Federal Agency Action. The third insurance is medical coverage for the volunteers themselves in case they're hurt on the job. The main difference between SAFE and the insurance programs provided by the Action Agency, which is covered by an outside insurance agency, is that SAFE would cover stipend payments during the time of that the injured person was unable to volunteer.
Wage continuation.
Yes, that's exactly right. That, and under this interpretation, that's legitimate. Mm-hmm. But that is the main difference.
So we get someone's paying for two of them now, two programs.
Well, the difference is that we pay 60 cents a year for volunteers for medical insurance for SEMA and the going SAFE rate for SAFE. 65 cents for personal liability and $3 for automobile insurance. Mm-hmm. Significant difference.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Stiver, did you want to give some testimony you had signed up, or were you just here to answer a question?
Okay.
I think that just a brief statement, Representative Reichen has pointed out that the, by the way, the identification in the first is not the senior volunteer program, it's senior companion.
Senior companion
program on the first page. It's where it says among the programs.
Yeah, we made a mistake.
The House made some amendments that we have on a separate sheet. Mm-hmm.
The problem arises that the programs were set up distinctly by the federal government simply to enable people to volunteer. Two of the programs were to enable low-income people who were otherwise thought not inclined nor able to volunteer if they weren't given some supplement for such things as cosmetic treatment, clothes, special clothes, not transportation for their car to and from their volunteer activity, but in case they did need extra car repairs, just to have a car, perhaps, and that to help them and that type of thing. So the funds were, the stipends were simply set up to be enabling funds. The difference is, of course, when we come to the state of Oregon, and there has never been an argument with us, with the agency, and SAFE has been, over my 12 years, tenure in the agency has been one where we've just tried to resolve this. SAFE is completely legitimate in its view of Oregon's, says that wages would be, that any payments made for services rendered, or if you're under the direct supervision of someone in the agency, then whatever you receive is recompense, or would be considered recompense for services rendered, therefore wages. However, the federal government expressly meant, when they said excluding wages, to prevent
so
that.
So they don't reimburse you to pay into
it? No, it has nothing to do with recompense for services rendered, and that is the major difference between the two agencies, the federal agency and SAFE.
Senator Brown.
And the total cost per year in workers' comp premiums is how much?
Well, it would vary with each particular agency, but the total amount for our volunteers, and I believe there are some...
$71,000.
Yes,
yeah.
$31,000 for SAFE, and we have about 400 some odd volunteers in the two programs concerned at roughly $5, say, so there's a difference between $31,000 and $2,000 in the total yearly premiums paid.
How much does it cost to cover, to carry a volunteer about per year?
For the same thing as SAFE for the medical.
No, how much it costs otherwise than insurance, how much can you buy a volunteer for the year?
And under the federal insurance?
No, just the your $2 an hour and those things. Max said something about for $31,000 you could have
four more employees.
That $31,000 would cover approximately the stipends for 11 new volunteers. Our stipends cost $2,088 a year is what it comes out to, and then there's some administrative costs in there. We have to pay for a director of the agency and so forth, and such things as insurance.
I was just thinking, if we put an emergency clause on this and got a four-month jump on it, you'd save $70,000. You could put on four more volunteers.
Yes, and we have guaranteed that we would not use the money saved for anything other than adding to the volunteer corps or their expenses.
Thank you.
It's good to note, Madam Chair, there is a great need for volunteers. That is why Dr. Stifel found this and used this mechanism to get more volunteers. And it's good to note that SAFE, you know, considered stipend as wages, but they are not considered such for in relating to unemployment or Social Security or retirement benefits.
So there's a little bit of an anomaly there.
Yes.
Okay, very good.
Pardon me, Madam Chairman. There is one other thing which, in weighing the two, one of the things which the federal legislation does preclude is that those volunteers receiving stipends, that money cannot be considered as an offset against their welfare, for example. Mm-hmm. And we do have a number of our volunteers under these two programs are on welfare. Were that money to be considered as wages, they would also lose their welfare. So, I mean, there are a lot of things in considering the money as wages which would impinge upon some very real things which they get, such as welfare payments.
Thank you. Any further questions? If not, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
I don't see anybody else signed up. Is there anyone else signed up? We'll close the public hearing.
Madam Chair,
do you want to take action on today?
Yes,
I would move we amend to put an emergency clause.
Let me find it. Max, do you have any objection to our putting an emergency clause on this?
So you move that?
To put an emergency clause. That's fine? Is that okay?
Fine. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Senator Brown moves that an emergency clause be added to House Bill 2883. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Motion carries. Senator McCoy moves that House Bill 2883 pass with a due pass recommendation to the floor as amended. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Houck?
Aye.
Senator Kitzhaber?
Aye.
Senator McCoy?
Aye.
Senator Wires? Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Hendrickson?
Aye. Senator McCoy will carry the bill. Okay, we're going to move back to the agenda now, and we're going to take up Senate Bill 101, which, as you recall, we voted out of the committee last week. We then had legislative counsel review it, and we found out we did a little overkill on the amendments, and so we're going to revise those. If you open your packet up, we had added certain amendments to further refine the bill.
Does everybody have? I don't have a copy. Do you have copies of them?
Yeah, and it's Legislative Council Draft 3 is the issue one.
Okay, should have Legislative Council Draft 3. This bill, as you recall, was a bill so that associations, and we defined associations, which would include labor unions, could offer mass marketing of insurance. Well, in one of the amendments, which we had adopted to carry over, to have some parallelism with other group insurance policies, is something that technically would defeat the purpose of our bill because it would make that association or that union be the policy holder, and that is not what the intention of the bill is that each individual member would be single policy holders, and the group would only be gathered for the purpose of mass marketing, and they would give the names of the individuals in the group to an agent that would be mass marketing and are offering a lower rate. So Legislative Council picked up on that, and what we're recommending upon their advice is that we delete, if you see your second page of our A endorsed bill, on page 2, lines, let's see.
On page 2, line 1.
No, we want to keep line 1 in. That's
delete bin organized.
and which shall be deemed the policyholder insuring members, employees, or employees of members' associations for the benefit of persons other than the association or its officers. Because the idea is not that the association will be the policyholder. So on page 2, A engrossed, well, let's say, I guess they've got some other amendments here with respect to the limitation of association. Do you want to explain that to us, Sean?
On this bill, the committee amended it at its last meeting in committee, and the total language that was picked up and put into the bill was too much language. Legislative Council draft number 3, which each of you have, shows the final version that recommended, which does pick up the language from the group Life and Health concerning the organization being organized and having an active existence for at least 1 year and having a constitution and bylaws. It leaves out the strict limitation concerning being deemed a policyholder.
Okay, but I don't see the language in here that deletes that language.
The Legislative Council amendment refers to the original bill. And so this would be the final version. This language, which was picked up by a committee amendment erroneously and has now been deleted.
Okay, so we'll have to have we'll have to have a separate motion to delete that, though, because that language is added.
It's not in your number 3 here.
The chair is going to move on the engrossed bill that page 2. Now, do we want to delete that bullet space, too, or just this language?
Only these 3 lines.
Okay, that the 3 lines beginning, and which shall be deemed the policyholder, and ending, or its officers be deleted.
And that appears where...
That is on your A engrossed...
Lines 1, 2, and 3.
Okay, I'm working...
1 and 2.
None of us have that.
Right. I'm working off your Xerox handy copy. Does everybody have that document? Does everybody have that? Those were the committee amendments that we added.
Okay.
Okay, well then we're not going to use this at all because we're dealing with the bill. We're going to have to deal with the bill we
found. This is
A. These are, if you adopt this piece of paper.
But you see, we've already adopted this language.
Right, so if you adopt this piece, this is what's going to go down the bill. And it chooses.
I know, but the problem is that this doesn't have language in it that deletes this. Okay. That's why I'm making that motion. Mm-hmm. And then the decided one is it to be.
Wait, I don't understand what's my
name. All right. Is there any questions? Okay, what we're doing now, the document that you have, the Engrossed bill, the Xerox copy, was the committee's last action. We adopted some amendments, and what we did was we really adopted too much, according to our legislative council, on this, because we made the association the policyholder, which would then prevent the mass marketing, because they do not want to be the policyholders. They want to offer to their members individual policies on a group basis. So that's why I'm moving the deletion of that language. Is there any discussion?
To delete this?
Yes. That's all I'm going to delete.
Fine.
Any objections? Okay, that motion will carry.
Yeah, I move the amendments that would be appropriate on Legislative Council number 3, dated May 31st.
Yes, all right. Senator Brown moves the amendments to Senate Bill 101 on the legislative draft 101-3. That simply reaffirms what we did in terms of the language we added to modify and define what an association is, that they have to be in existence for 1 year and has a constitution and bylaws.
It gives the commissioner
rules. And gives the commissioner authority to make rules to implement this section. Okay. Is there any discussion? Second thought. I think procedurally we should have... Did we have to reconsider the vote? To bring the bill back in.
No, the bill would go out if we pass. benefit as amended recommendation.
Is it going to pass?
Okay. I just wanted to check because I want to make sure that we're procedurally correct.
Wait, now, did we?
So I think the first motion that I'm going to make is that we
reconsider
the bill, since the bill had been sent out. We voted the bill out last week, and so I think before we deal with the bill, I think I got a little bit ahead of myself. Before we deal with the bill with respect to amending it, we need to bring it back into the committee because it's sent out to the committee.
I so move that we reconsider.
Okay, Senator Brown moves that we reconsider and bring the bill back into committee. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Hannon?
Aye.
Senator Hout?
Aye.
Senator Kitzhaber?
Aye.
Senator McCoy?
Aye.
Senator Wires? Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Hendrickson?
Aye. All right, the bill is back in committee, and the chair will now move, since the bill is in our possession, that on second page, line 2, those three lines which I referred to earlier, and which shall be deemed the policyholder and ends or its officers, be deleted from the bill. Is there any objection? Hearing none, that will be added. Senator Brown moves that the amendments proposed in LC draft, is it 101-3?
101-3.
A-3 be adopted, the bill as originally drafted. That would simply ratify what we have done with respect to the other amendments. Is there any objections? Hearing none, that's the order.
I move that we send the bill out due pass, Madam Chairman.
Senator Brown moves that Senate Bill 101,
as amended,
be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hannon?
Aye.
Senator Houck?
Aye.
Senator Kitzhaber?
Aye.
Senator McCoy?
Aye.
Senator Wires? Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Hendrickson?
Aye. Bill is sent to the floor. Senator Hannon again will be assigned to carry it. I hope we don't have to reel it back in.
Okay.
We're going to move next to Senate Bill 580, which is the school bus driver's bill. Is there somebody here to testify on that?
I'll be available.
Okay. Now, are these all new people testifying? Or is this from the last?
We might ask Mr. Dorsey.
Okay, we have a large number of people signed up on this bill. Frankly, I would like to work on this bill and get it out today, and if we have a large number of people, these are all people in support of the bill, and we have a lot of other bills that we're going to have to deal with today. Is there, perhaps could we summarize, I hate to cut people off that are here from, or could people come up and very briefly testify?
Senator, Madam Chairperson, I'm Robert Snyder. I'm the general counsel to Dorsey Bus. I'm not first on the list, but I have written testimony in there, and basically my intention was to, and in my testimony is just to describe what the bill and the amendment to the bill is doing to the existing law. So maybe if I can go first, I can set the stage for where we are here. I think you all have copies of my written testimony in front of you. The Senate Bill 580 amends the existing code sections to remove school bus drivers employed by private operators from one section of the ORS 279.334, and it adds them to another section, ORS 279.340. ORS 279.334, as it exists, and there's a copy attached to my testimony, requires in essence that where labor is employed by a school district through a contractor, no person shall be required or permitted to labor more than 8 hours in any one day or 40 hours in any one week, except in which event the person or persons so employed for excessive hours shall receive at least time and a half for all overtime in excess of 8 hours a day, and for work performed on Saturday and Sunday and certain holidays as defined in the ORS. ORS 279.340, there's a copy of that also attached, provides that labor employed by a school district or other municipality shall be paid overtime for labor performed in excess of 8 hours in any one day or 40 hours in any one week at least time and a half. The section does not mention weekends or holidays. This section basically defines the minimum overtime obligation of the state of Oregon or municipalities or school districts of the state of Oregon. Senate Bill 580, as originally introduced, added labor employed by school bus contractors to the provisions of ORS 279.340. This left ORS 279.334 intact and also apparently affecting labor employed by school contractors. Accordingly, to correct this anomaly, the amendment to Bill 580 was introduced to make ORS 279.334 not apply to labor employed by school bus contractors. So the bill and the amendment are logically consistent in that one, it adds this class of employee to one section, takes it out of the other.
And this would only affect school bus driving, but through school bus contractors.
That's
correct?
Right.
And it would not open it up any further than that.
Just school bus drivers employed by school bus contractors in the state of Oregon. Might also add that the federal law sets minimum overtime standards for employees of school bus contractors in the absence of state statute. In my judgment, the federal regulations regarding minimum overtime standards would apply in the absence here of any state statute. Those regulations, in fact, control most of the private employers in this state. Woodworkers and that type of employee. Those regulations basically require the payment of time and a half for work performed in excess of 40 hours per week. They permit an employer to employ a person for more than 8 hours in any one day without paying overtime, so long as the person does not work more than 40 hours in that week. The passage of the amendment to Senate Bill 580 to remove the school bus contractors from ORS 279.334, but not the original Senate Bill 580, adding school bus contractors to ORS 279.340, would, in my judgment, leave the employees of school bus contractors subject to the federal rules. Application of the federal overtime rule is the most appropriate for school bus drivers employed by private contractors, I believe. The consequences of the overtime law as it now exists is that school bus contractors will not employ a driver to work over 8 hours per day or on weekends unless absolutely necessary. In fact, if you'll go back to the language of ORS 279.334, it even states that, quote, no person shall be permitted to labor more than 8 hours unless necessary.
Now, as I understand the state provision, if they do go over 8 hours, they still would get time and a half for over 8 hours.
That's right. That's
and
the
if
state.
There was not funds available, they would get comp time. At least that's the way it works with school districts, isn't it?
Yes, mm-hmm. I think that's right.
So you would be under that provision, but hopefully you would be not in a situation where you
yeah,
would
we,
have
I think
available.
We'd have to pay overtime.
Yeah.
Not.
Because you would not be
time.
A municipality, right?
Right.
Or a school district.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. The... I think the testimony of some of the folks here who drive school buses will explain to you why the over 8 hour a day rule is not beneficial to them.
Madam Chair,
Senator McCoy,
what is a normal work hour day?
Yeah.
For people presently?
A school bus driver works 3 to 5 hours a day. The basic shift is to take the children to school in the morning. That takes a very short route would be an hour. That's probably more than one round, but an hour to an hour and a half or so. So they work less than 8 hours in one day on what's called home to school, the routes, and that's every day. And then the school districts have athletic trips and field trips and that sort of thing. At least in our company, it's on a rotation and seniority basis that those trips are assigned to the drivers that also drive the regular route trips. But under the law as it exists, if the home-to-school route was, let's say, 4 hours and the field trip is 5 hours, that puts that driver into the overtime. It makes it a 9-hour day, so there's an hour of overtime that has to be paid. So we would then assign that trip to another driver who hadn't worked 4 hours that day to keep it under the 8 hours of overtime. The effect of that is that the drivers get less work per week. They still don't work 40 hours a week. Basically, a school bus driver is driving as a part-time job.
Madam Chairperson, they get paid by the hour, is that right?
That's right.
They get paid by the hour. They get benefits.
Yes.
They get the benefits. But for only 4 hours a day, so 20 hours a week.
That's right.
I mean, how do they live?
Most school bus drivers are... we have a number of folks who are retired military. It's a person generally who doesn't have to rely on that job for all.
In our comparable worth testimony, Helen Remick told us a lot of them are women that work.
That's true.
Yeah. Oh, I see. So
the bus drivers that get the city bus drivers that get full time job and. A lot of fringes in Bay Area.
In fact, there are only 5 conclusive presumptions in Oregon civil law. There are rarities, and we're not going to have one. I'll run the show real quick.
Okay. I don't... Senator Houck, you might want to sit at the other end. Can you see okay there?
All
cardiologist at the UCLA School of Medicine. I've been a consultant for the Los Angeles City Fire Department since 1972, and during this time have become vitally interested in the heart disease problem of firefighters. Los Angeles City firefighters, like firefighters from most other cities, receive more disability pensions for heart disease than any other illness. Despite the fact that many valuable man hours are lost each year, little attempt has been made to understand and or reduce the heart disease problem in firefighters. This slide shows that the term heart disease is a general term which includes many different heart problems. The major heart problem afflicting firefighters, and the one I am primarily concerned with, is ischemic heart disease, which simply means that the supply of blood and oxygen to the heart muscle is not adequate to meet the demands. Ischemia is usually caused by coronary artery disease, resulting from cholesterol and other fatty substances accumulating in the coronary arteries. On the left is a normal coronary artery. On the right is an artery which is 75% occluded. This type of occlusion may cause severe ischemia during exercise or work when the oxygen demands of the heart increase. If the ischemia becomes too severe, a myocardial infarction or heart attack occurs. This means that part of the heart tissue has been injured, as shown in this slide. Ischemic heart disease can be more accurately assessed with an exercise stress electrocardiogram than with the normal resting electrocardiogram. Many people with ischemic heart disease have normal electrocardiograms at rest. This slide shows normal and abnormal electrocardiographic tracings. A rather consistent indicator of ischemia is a prolonged period of time needed for the tracing to rise after it has reached its lowest point. The electrocardiogram from this firefighter is normal at rest. However, When his heart rate is increased to 145 beats per minute, ischemic changes are seen in the electrocardiogram, which become more pronounced during recovery. This man did not have chest pains or angina and thought he was in good health. Further medical examination revealed that he had severe coronary artery disease and was a high-risk subject for sudden death. This slide illustrates a normal electrocardiographic stress test with a firefighter exercising at near maximal heart rate. These men were subjects in a study conducted at UCLA on a randomly selected group of Los Angeles City firefighters 40 years of age and over. 10% had ischemic electrocardiographic responses to near maximal exercise. The 10% ischemic responses observed in the firefighters is higher than the 8% ischemic responses observed in a group of highly coronary prone insurance executives previously studied at UCLA. These values are both higher than the 5 to 6% ischemic responses reported for other groups, including police officers and airline pilots. This slide shows that in general, the firefighters in our study had low risk factors for coronary artery disease. The three major risk factors are elevated cholesterol, elevated blood pressure or hypertension, and smoking. Only one firefighter had all three risk factors elevated. Five had two factors elevated, and 47 had none of the three risk factors elevated. Of the nine men who had ischemic responses, only four had elevated risk factors. Firefighter LB had elevated triglycerides, another one of the fats found in the blood in addition to cholesterol. NB had high blood pressure and was obese, as indicated by his skinfold fat measurements. He was a firefighter who had severe coronary artery disease. Since firefighters are a medically selected population with low risk factors for coronary artery disease, the observed 10% incidence of ischemic responses is indeed surprising and suggests that ischemic heart disease in firefighters is job-associated. In order to understand some of the stress which is imposed on firefighters' hearts, initial studies were conducted in the laboratory at UCLA. Firefighters were asked to do sudden strenuous exercise on the treadmill without the benefit of prior warm-up. This slide shows that of the 44 men studied, 43% had ischemic responses and 25% had other abnormal electrocardiographic changes. When warm-up, consisting of 2 minutes of easy jogging in place, preceded the sudden exercise, the electrocardiogram was normal in most cases. Unfortunately, firefighters don't always have time to warm up. Further studies were conducted to record heart rate and electrocardiographic changes from the men while on the job. This slide shows the recorder which the men were using during their normal 24-hour workday. While responding to the alarm, heart rate showed an average increase of 47 beats per minute, 15 to 30 seconds after the alarm. The increases ranged from 12 to 117 beats per minute. These results indicate an emotional response while reacting to the alarm. The most dramatic responses were observed at night while the men were sleeping. Even while on the truck, heart rate still remained elevated. These data also illustrate that heart rate response is the same in more experienced as well as less experienced firefighters. Some abnormal electrocardiographic responses were observed 15 to 30 seconds after the alarm sounded. These abnormal responses were similar to those observed in the sudden exercise experiments conducted in the laboratory and may indicate ischemic insult to the heart. Here we see the heart rate data obtained from one firefighter responding to 7 alarms during one day. What effect these repeated exposures to emotional stress had on this man's heart and coronary vessels over 15 years of service remains to be determined. These heart rate data were obtained from 2 men while approaching structure fires. Before getting off of the truck, their heart rates were 150 beats per minute, again indicating an emotional response. This slide shows the heart rate responses from a firefighter working two consecutive structure fires. 20 seconds after the alarm sounded, his heart rate had increased from 100 to 148 beats per minute. While on the truck, it increased further to 152 beats per minute. During the initial stages of the first fire, his heart rate reached 190 beats per minute. While returning to the station from the first fire, they received an audio call to respond to a second fire. Immediately, his heart rate increased to 152 beats per minute. During the initial stages of the second fire, he was working on the roof when flames came up on all four sides. His heart rate reached 195 beats per minute and averaged 188 beats per minute for 15 minutes. When tested in the laboratory, he could not get his heart rate to exceed 190 beats per minute. These data also indicate emotional stress. These data from another firefighter do not show the emotional response to the alarm, but do show high heart rates during actual firefighting. Many factors could be responsible for these extremely high heart rates observed for prolonged periods during actual firefighting. Yeah. These include the physical work involved in firefighting, the heat stress, the nature of the protective gear, emotional stress, and breathing noxious fumes such as carbon monoxide. This slide shows both the weight and nature of the equipment and the extreme heat to which firefighters are exposed. In order to obtain additional information, another study was conducted in the laboratory to test the effect of the protective gear and the heat on heart rate while working on the treadmill for 15 minutes. Tests were conducted at 72 degrees Fahrenheit in the regular blue uniform, and then with the turnout and breather. The third test was conducted in the sauna at 180 degrees Fahrenheit with the turnout and breather. Note that the heart rate continues to rise as one continues to work in the turnout gear at high temperatures. This is largely due to the continuous rise in body temperature. However, these factors alone are not responsible for the very high heart rates observed for prolonged periods during firefighting. The emotional stress must be important. In conclusion, our studies show that firefighters do indeed have a heart disease problem. A random sample of Los Angeles firefighters had 10% ischemic responses during the stress electrocardiographic test, indicating the possibility of coronary artery disease. This is higher than the 8% ischemic responses observed in a group of Los Angeles insurance executives. These findings are very surprising when we consider that the firefighters were a medically selected population, were in good physical condition due to a fitness program, and have low risk factors for coronary artery disease. These facts suggest that stress associated with the job of firefighting may be causing damage to the heart and coronary arteries. Electrocardiographic recordings obtained from firefighters while on duty show that their hearts are subject to abnormal stress. Working in turnout gear in hot environments also places stress on the heart. All of these factors, plus the noxious fumes to which firefighters were exposed, may contribute to the high incidence of ischemic stress tests observed in firefighters.
Well, that was very interesting. I was wondering if we could get a stress test on legislators and see how we'd...
Well, Madam Chair, I'm thinking that if we pass this bill, we can probably push those insurance executives right up to that 10% level.
Oh, we will be probably adding to their stress.
I'd like to say, one of the sponsors of the
bill.
Glenn Whalen's retired Portland firefighter and insurance executive.
So he's a double.
Double West, keep us under our hat. Alarm. One clarification there. The term medically selected is used. I'd like to stress that these are the cream of the crop, the physical cream of the crop, these people going in. We just conducted a test for entrance examination in Salem.
Just identify yourself.
Well, I'm Tom Whalen again, Oregon State Firefighters Council. And we've got about 250 people on the list, I think. The examination was 50% physical, 50% intellectual exam. And you've got the people at the top of that list are truly the cream of the crop. And there was a weeding out of, it's not unusual to find 600 to 1,000 people apply for a department where there's only going to be two or three or six openings. So.
And they usually have to take physical agility tests.
Yes, half that is a physical agility strength test. And so you find in 15
so
to 20 years.
So you're starting with people that are in excellent health.
Just an incredibly select group of people, and then finding 15, 20 years down the line disabilities at the rate that we're talking about.
I found it very informative, that constant stress on their hearts.
Mm-hmm.
You know it has to take.
Yeah, here in Salem in the last 6 years, since we've gone into the emergency medical business, the run volume has probably increased fourfold in that period of time. And so those bells are going off that much more. It's not unusual to go 6-8 runs a day.
Okay, now do you want to explain to us, I guess you've explained to us pretty much that what this bill would do then is it sets up a disputable presumption
for people
that are applying for where they do have a lung or respiratory or a heart or respiratory problem.
Yeah. Senator Hendrickson, I go through one more time. The current presumption, the facts that have to be met would not be changed. 5 years as a firefighter, pre-employment physical that failed to disclose any abnormality, and a heart or lung or renal disability. What this would change is the standard of proof that the insurer would have to meet to deny a claim. He would have to meet a clear and convincing standard, and he would have to, in our view, point more certainly to a cause other than the firefighter's employment that created this disability.
Okay. Are there any questions, Mr. Whalen?
You want to move it up?
Yeah, I think he is the only one signed up test file. Let me just check before we close the public ticket away. Yes, Mr. Whalen is the only one signed up. Is there anyone else here that wishes to test file?
I move House Bill 2700 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator McCoy moves House Bill 2700 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Hammond?
Aye.
Senator Houck?
Aye.
Senator Kitzhaber?
Aye.
Senator McCoy?
Aye.
Senator Wyers?
Aye.
Senator Brown? Senator Hendrickson?
Aye. Senator Kitzhaber, would you carry this bill? You're a medical specialist here.
Damn what? You were in off.
Put money in there.
All right.
You read your mind on it, Madam Chair.
55.
Okay, now let's move up to our packet of worker compensation bills. Let's start with Senate Bill 555. And Rick Roll is signed up to testify. And Mr. Van Roski, do you want to testify on that also? Or?
Madam Chairperson, we did offer some testimony on that last Wednesday.
Okay.
I thought that Mr. Roll would testify on that also.
Okay. This is the issue where maybe if both of you could come up to the table, that will open up the public hearing. This is the bill of which entitles the worker compensation claimant to additional compensation when the person is not medically stationary. And Mr. Van Roski was in opposition to the bill, and Mr. Roll was a proponent of the bill.
I'd identify for the record, I'm Dennis Van Roski. I'm the president of the Association of Workers' Compensation Defense Attorneys. Any comments that I make, besides being personal, are a compilation of decisions made or positions taken by self-insured employers and carriers.
Okay. So you just represent self-insurers,
both self-insureds and insurance carriers.
Okay. Mr. Roll, did you want to identify yourself for the record, and if you have any
comments?
I know we were we went through these rather rapidly last week, so.
All right, I'm Rick Roll, a lawyer from Tillamook. I represent injured workers, and I'm here on behalf of International Woodworkers Union, Western States Regional Council Number 3, that represents workers primarily in the lumber industry.
Okay.
Now, you're a proponent.
He's a proponent of the bill.
Proponent of the bill.
Okay.
And this, he's an opponent?
He's in opposition to the bill, yes. This is where we have plaintiff bar and defense bar.
Well, while we're talking about
Senator
that,
Wires, yeah.
I'd like to declare a potential conflict of interest on this bill because I represent injured workers.
Okay. Mr. Roll, why don't you briefly go through again the reasons for this bill? We have gone through a lot of bills since this one came up, and just to refresh our recollection.
The situation we discussed last time was, the point that I raised last time was the one question raised by a case called the Weller case, decided by the Oregon Supreme Court and enforced by the other courts on the workers' compensation system. And that particular decision seems to indicate that a symptom is not part of a disease, and that before a condition can be compensable, there must be shown a worsening of an underlying disease condition as opposed to a symptom. And that has caused considerable confusion, and it has led to repeated court decisions under facts where there is no dispute that work caused a worsening of pain or some problem to the extent that someone was rendered unable to work, but because there was no evidence that the underlying condition, whether it be heart disease or a spinal injury or a ruptured disc or something, had worsened, there was it was found that the person was not entitled to compensation. And the distinction drawn is one between a temporary worsening of symptoms as opposed to a permanent worsening of an underlying condition. And it's, at least I advance on behalf of the parties that I represent, and it's my own personal opinion, that if work or working conditions render someone unable to work, whether it's temporarily, or if work renders someone more permanently disabled, that it's a workers' compensation issue and it should be result in a compensable.
Okay. I am not
finding.
A worker comp lawyer, so I'm trying to educate myself here. So the effect of the bill then would allow a person to be able to reopen their claim.
Yes.
Upon a showing that they are not medically stationary.
Yes, which means the legal definition of that is that a disabling condition is no longer expected to improve over a period of time or with further medical treatment. At that point, you are not medically stationary when you are not expected to improve further. The concept of medically stationary is the key concept, which either results in payment or non-payment of wage loss benefits while someone is not able to work. So if you have a temporary worsening of symptoms and you are unable to work, if this bill were in effect, a person unable to work who was not medically stationary because the work caused a temporary worsening of symptoms would be entitled to receive workers' compensation wage loss benefits while they were unable to work. At the point where they become medically stationary, the laws, as already written, would result in termination of the wage loss benefits. At the present time, if there is a temporary worsening of symptoms, which is a medical opinion and would obviously vary from case to case, there may not be wage loss benefits allowed, even though there's no dispute that the job caused the worsening and there's no dispute that the person is unable to work because of the Weller decision, which says you have to have a permanent change in the underlying condition before you can receive compensation.
So would I be correct in saying, and I'll let Mr. Brasky have some comments too, that at this point, if a person is under those circumstances, they cannot get a time loss or wage loss payment?
Well, there are the cases are strange, and I'm not sure they're entirely clear, but there are many instances where people have been denied benefits on the basis that they have not shown a permanent change in the underlying condition.
Thank you. I'd like to welcome the high school. What grade are you? They're from Illinois Valley High School in Cave Junction, and we welcome you to the Senate Labor Committee. Is your teacher here today, or what class is this? Senior?
It's an advanced placement history class, U.S. history, the juniors.
Oh, very good. Well, welcome. And we're discussing issues dealing with injured workers today. And I'm glad to have you here. Mr. Vorosky, did you want to...
Yes, Madam Chairperson, with respect to Senate Bill 555, I'm trying to summarize what we testified about last Wednesday. I don't think that this bill addresses the problem that Mr. Roll indicates, the Weller problem, which is a piece of work by the court which has taken on various and sundry interpretations. The problem with this bill really is that it causes reopening of claims when it's not necessary to reopen claims. Under present law, if there is a worsening of the compensable condition, whether it's temporary or permanent, the claim is caused to be reopened, and the claimant is paid his benefits, and the claim is then closed, and you can litigate whether there's any additional permanent disability on account of the claim. So this doesn't satisfy that problem of whether a symptom, a temporary worsening of a symptom, is a compensable claim or not. That's a question that's dealt with in the initial phases of the claim, whether the initial claim is compensable or not.
Well, what about, what do you think the effect of the language "or is no longer medical stationary" would do then?
Well, I think that there are a myriad of cases where a claimant may become non-medically stationary, and yet it does not require formal reopening of the claim, which gets into another litigation process. There are those cases where a worker can continue to work with a non-medically stationary claim. There are a lot of those cases. The doctor says the condition isn't stationary, but he can continue to work. There are many of those cases which are addressed, and that does not require reopening of the claim for aggravation purposes. Also, there are many cases in which permanent partial disability has been awarded. Let's just assume a case of 20% permanent partial disability, and the claimant returns to work either in the same capacity or for some other employer, and he has bouts of problems relating to his injury. There are those cases that say, well, that's a waxing and a waning. You can expect, you presume, that a claimant is going to have additional problems in the future simply by the fact that he's been granted judicially a permanent disability award. That's what permanent means. It means chronic. So there will be chronic problems cropping up from time to time that should not require formal reopening of the claim so that you can litigate all over again.
But how do you handle the situation if the person isn't medical stationary and isn't able to work and isn't able to get a time loss payment?
Then his doctor says that his condition is worsened, and the present language takes care of that. It requires reopening of the claim. Medically stationary is kind of a term of art that's been bandied around to determine, we use it sometimes to determine whether there in fact is a worsening. But to put that additional language, that additional burden in an aggravation claim, I don't think is justified under the circumstances that we have. If a claimant's condition worsens and there's medical verification of the worsening, then the claim can be reopened under the present language.
Mm-hmm. So, Madam Chairperson?
In other words,
you're saying then that this bill does not address that problem that you're speaking of, or it's already addressed.
It's already addressed.
It's already addressed.
Yes, Senator, it's already addressed.
And
okay. I see
that other people agree with you.
I have a question for Mr. Roll. In our fiscal impact statement, it says it has a retrospective effect. Is that your interpretation of the bill? In other words, people would be able to go back and pick up back claims, or is it your belief that it's retrospective?
That's really a question that I'm probably not qualified to answer, but I'll try anyway.
Or what was your intention, I guess, maybe in terms of... I know you're not the requester of the bill, but...
I would not anticipate that it would have a retrospective effect unless the argument was made to a court and they determined that was legislative intent. But
because that would lower the fiscal impact, obviously.
It seems to indicate by the language of the bill that there must be evidence presented which would show a non-medically stationary status, which would then result in the further payment of benefits. And I would think that with regard to those people who had done so in the past and had already had rulings on their cases, that they would be bound by the finality of whatever decision had already been reached.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Are there any further questions?
Yes.
Senator Hannan?
Conceivably, could I be an injured worker and I'm released back to a work situation?
Are you addressing, who do you address your question to?
The defense
attorney. Okay.
And the doctor has tentatively declared that I'm medically stationary. Then all of a sudden I start getting back pains, and it's diagnosed that the work is in fact contributing to inflammation or something in my back. What you're saying is, I understand it, with existing language, then the doctor would make a declaration that the person is medically unstationary, but he would still continue to work.
If he's capable, Senator, if he's capable of continuing to work, that the doctor will allow him to do so.
Okay.
Even though he's not medically stationary and needs additional curative treatment.
Okay. Now, the new language that's being proposed, I don't know, it appears that we're playing a game of semantics here of what the definition is, and I'm trying to get to the bottom here of what this new language would indicate. The claimant's condition is worsened and is no longer medically stationary. Now, you just indicated for the record that the previous situation would almost be duplicative of the new language under the existing language. Now, can you separate that for us and show us what the distinction is?
Senator, probably the problem here is that there are technical requirements in the law that require certain actions by the carrier or the employer.
Mm-hmm.
Under an aggravation statute, which this is supposed to be, when a claimant has a claim and a claim is closed,